equitable rights of subrogation in a personal injury case are essentially worthless if the Court of Appeals opinion is the correct statement of the law in this case. This is because despite the fact that there was a settlement nearly six times the amount of the subrogation claim in this case, and the trial court disposed of the subrogation interest by summary judgment.
Do you think there's any limit on subrogation based upon the recovery of the claimant? What if the settlement was just the amount of your subrogation claim or less than the amount of your subrogation claim? You mentioned just now it was six times the amount, but what if it was that amount or less than that amount?
Sometimes there's instances where an insurance company will pay more under their insurance policy than a jury would ascribe to the damages suffered by that person. So there are instances where the subrogation lien is in fact more than the most the person could hope to obtain from the jury, just given the nature is as conservative as juries have been in the past decades and awards as well, especially in personal injury cases. Typically, they're not giving out. In the past, there's been larger awards for personal and for mental anguish, pain, and suffering like that. Typically, the history with juries lately is those awards haven't been quite as large. So, yes, the circumstance could arise where the amounts are equal.
Didn't answer the question. What's the answer to the question? What happens in that scenario?
Well, under an equitable standpoint, if the jury determines that the amounts are equal, then the carrier would recover the entire amount.
What if there's a settlement, as there often is, and the lien is substantially more than the settlement? What role does the subrogation have? My experience has been the subrogation has either been resolved before there's an approved settlement, the subrogation lien has been resolved so that you don't have the situation that you have here. But what happens when, as Justice Wainwright asked, when the lien is substantially more or more than whatever the settlement or jury award may be?
Well, we would submit that if the contractual policy language is upheld, the situation would work the same as it would work in workers' compensation, which provides a first money right of subrogation. And it's a workable situation because the employee doesn't settle the case if they know that they have to pay back all the money to the carrier. And so there's leverage on both sides in that type of circumstance. There's the leverage that the employee or the insured has to bring the claim because they are the plaintiff and they basically control the litigation. So they determine whether or not they're going to have a settlement or not. And the situation works in workers' compensation standpoints because the employee will not settle if the carrier doesn't agree to reduce the lien beforehand. But in this type of circumstance, it doesn't work because the employee or the insured has all the leverage. They can pursue the claim, and the carrier really can't pursue the claim on their own if the insured is. If you get to a situation like such as this case where if we had come to trial, the plaintiff wouldn't have wanted us to participate in trial in all likelihood because the plaintiff typically doesn't want the jury to hear about the collateral source of insurance benefits it received. And so if we get, you know, a three-week trial, as Ford contended in this case, you get halfway through and the employee settles the case, how is the carrier going to pick up the ball and all of a sudden introduce itself to the jury and go with the case there? So the employee, in an equitable circumstance, controls the litigation, but they also control the settlement because they can always compromise the carrier's second money to get the deal done.
I understand that, but can't the carrier put the parties on notice of the lien so that any settlement proceeds would have to satisfy the carrier or certainly be negotiated with the carrier to some extent?
Well, in this case, that didn't work. The parties were clearly on notice of the lien. We intervened in the case and had been in the case for 3 years before it came time to, shortly before trial, the case settled. So the notice didn't do us any good. They went ahead and they settled, and then they got a summary judgment from the court that as a matter of law, they weren't made whole, so we don't recover anything. And so they have, in an equitable standpoint, if the court doesn't follow the language of the contract, they have all the control because they can decide when to settle the case, and they can settle it short. Because in most any case, it should be anticipated that they wouldn't go to trial when they have an offer for just their damages, just to go get money back to pay it back to the carrier. They wouldn't go through the hardship of the trial, the emotional draw of the trial, just to go through it. So in most any case, it should be anticipated that they settle, they reduce the amount of the carrier's second money to get the thing done. And so that's why it's an unworkable circumstance in equitable subrogation rights, as opposed to the situation that does work in a workers' comp standpoint.
Because it's statutory.
Yes, the workers' compensation, Texas Labor Code is statutory, and this court has upheld that the carrier gets back first money because that's what the statute provides, and that the made-whole rule doesn't apply because the statute provides. We would submit that the parties are free to contract as they will and have contractual language that has the same circumstance set up as the workers' compensation standpoint, that the carrier gets paid back first. The appellees would submit that this is overreaching by the carrier. In particular, the Court of Appeals opinion below cited the Esparza case, where it stated, this basic principle, which is the principle of made whole, cannot be summarily overcome by a boilerplate provision in an insurance contract that purports to entitle the insurer to subrogation out of the first monies received by the insurer. Defined otherwise would be to defeat the fundamental contractual expectations of the average insurer. The problem that I have with that is all insurance contract language is boilerplate. It's approved by the Texas Department of Insurance, and it's in the same generally for every insurer that buys that particular policy. So this is basically a wide-reaching statement, if applied, that any language would have an insurance policy would have to be the subject of whether or not the insured expected it. The insured's expectations as to what it should receive under insurance policy should be governed by the language of the policy, with two exceptions. Whether or not the insurance language of the policy violates public policy or whether it's unconscionable. In this particular case, we submit that it doesn't violate public policy because there are other statutory provisions that provide the same type of first money relief that we seek to have enforced by virtue of our contract. Namely, the workers' compensation statute has that. There's also federal statutes. The longshore statute and the Medicare statute all provide for first money rights of subrogation. Additionally, it provides a more workable situation as far as being able to liquidate the amount that the carrier is entitled to recover because the amount of the lien is typically very easy to prove up in a workers' comp standpoint. However, if it's a second money right, then there's going to have to be, whenever there's a settlement, if there's not an agreement, there's going to have to be a trial where the carrier has to put on evidence or the employee has to put on evidence as to what all their damages were from the accident, and then determine what the back end amount is that comes to the carrier. It's a difficult situation to litigate. Even if the carrier does receive a trial in the case, which it didn't in this particular case.
What makes it so difficult? I mean, you're essentially saying that whatever you pay, whether it's reasonable, necessary for the treatment of this individual, you need a carte blanche check of reimbursement. And sometimes our charges are susceptible. Is it suspect for whatever reason it shouldn't have been done? Like a government contract, sometimes they charge you $500 for a hammer. The reasonable cost of a hammer is $2.49 at Walmart. Why shouldn't those charges be reviewable?
Well, they're reviewable in that the jury, if you went to the trial, would have to assess all the elements of damages if made whole apply. And so it would have to take evidence of a plaintiff who's already settled the case to get up there and talk about what their pain and suffering is, what their mental anguish is, and also what the medical expenses are as well, too. So it's much more complex because under the equitable test, you have to look at all those elements of damages in particular. In a workers' comp standpoint, this court held in the Franks v. Symantec case that if the carriers paid the amounts, then it's entitled to recover those amounts, at least from the employee, without having proving whether it's reasonable or necessary. And a carrier doesn't necessarily have an incentive to pay unreasonable amounts. In this particular case, they submitted an affidavit that stated that they had $378,000 worth of medical, but we, in fact, paid $247,000. You know, in most cases, there's audits that are performed by the insurance company where they'll pay 50 cents on the dollar. And so oftentimes the employee will want to go in front of the jury and ask for a larger amount than the amount that's even been paid by the carrier. And also the Civil Practice and Remedies Code has been, in the past 3 years, changed too, that the employee can only recover the amount actually paid for benefits as well from the third party. So typically, I don't think you're going to have a situation where a carrier has paid out more than it should have in a case. It's going to pay reasonable necessary charges, and typically doctors are going to complain that they didn't pay enough in a particular case.
What about the notion that insurance contracts are essentially contracts of adhesion, where the insured really has little, if any, negotiating power to alter the terms of the contract?
Well, just because it's a contract of an adhesion doesn't mean that it's against public policy. They are set up in such a manner that they're reviewed by the Texas Department of Insurance. Ms. Cantu, in her response, presents some outlandish examples of if you apply the strict reading of our subrogation clause in our particular policy is so broad that she submits that it would go after perhaps her life insurance benefits or money that she got from unemployment benefits. I don't think a broad reading of a subrogation statute is probably not going to get by the Texas Department of Insurance, but if it does, it's still going to be subject to review by courts, just like any other provisions of insurance clauses under the doctrines of public policy and unconscionability. And so if it's extremely overbroad, then the court will have a remedy to strike that down. It's just our position in this case that a simple first money right of subrogation is not against public policy because it provides a workable situation, and it also is what's set up in other types of statutory subrogation. Let me touch briefly on the language of the policy as well, too, because that issue was raised by the appellee in the case. In the language of the policy that we're dealing with from Fortis provides two different rights. It provides expressly a subrogation right, and it states that upon payment of benefits will be subrogated to all rights that the recovery that the person has against the third party. But it also provides a broader right, which it calls a right of reimbursement, and it states that in a separate clause called right of reimbursement, it states if benefits are paid under this plan and any covered person recovers against any person or organization by settlement or judgment or otherwise, we have a right to recover from that covered person an amount equal to the amount that we've paid. So appellees contend that our language is not, on one hand, they contend that it's not concise enough to state that we have a first money right, but then on the other hand, they contend that it's so broad that it could reach some of their other benefits as well, too. I think that clearly this provides a first money right of subrogation because it defines the amount that you recover if you settle under the right of reimbursement clause, and it's the amount equal to the amount that we pay. In this particular case, we presented summary judgment evidence that we had paid $247,000, and so the amount's liquidated, it's clear, and the language is clear as well, too.
Any questions?
provision doesn't use the term first lien.
No, it does not.
You could get, in fact, completely reimbursed from second money, so to speak, depending on the circumstances.
Well, it defines the amount that we'll recover. It says that we'll recover the amount that we're paid.
It doesn't say when, though. It doesn't say before everybody else. It doesn't say after everybody else. It doesn't say after some and before others. It just says you'll get paid the amount that you expended. It doesn't say when, though.
It suggests that we'll be paid that out of the settlement. It says if the person recovers against any person or organization,
well, I don't dispute that. You're saying you get first money, and I don't see any. I'm trying to ask you what language in here points to your right being first. We have a right to recover from that covered person an amount equal to the amount we paid. First, second, third, I don't see an order in there.
It could be second as long as it comes out of that settlement pot.
That's what I just said. Yes. So long as you were paid, you wouldn't care if it were second money.
Yes.
But here, there's not enough to cover first and second, so you want to be first.
Well, first money or second money out of that settlement. Now, the question of whether or not that settlement covers all the damages is a different question. If we have, in this particular case, a $1.4 million settlement, and Ms. Cantu says we have $10 million worth of jury damages based on, you know, these things that the jury could award us, you don't get any of this $1.4. That's different than if we say we get $247 out of your $1.4. So, yes, you can have the first $1.2, and then we get $247 out of that $1.4. What this says is that we get paid the amount that we've paid out of the recovery that they make. Irrespective, we submit that that's irrespective of what the total damages are that the jury may or may not have given.
Any other questions? Thank you, Counselor.
Thank you.
The court's ready to hear argument. You may respond.
May it please the court, Mr. Coward, who sent argument to respond.
May it please the court, Tom Coward for respondent Vanessa Cantu. I'm accompanied by Mike Keeney before, but he's graciously allowed me to have all the time. In our view, Your Honor,
the fourth position, it's still out of the case.
Yes, sir.
Yeah.
And we agree with that, as we responded in the petition for review statement. In our view, the real issue here is that under Texas law, who should bear the risk of a loss caused by a culpable third party, the insured or the insurance company? And we think under longstanding Texas law that's supported by substantial and valid public policies is consistent with the majority rule in the United States and works.
Well, if it's just equity, court could just decide what was fair and what was right. But you've got a contract here.
Yes, sir.
And so why isn't that different?
We think that the Texas law says it's different. Stretching back to 1913 in the Camden Fire case out of the Dallas Court of Appeals, which actually had a contractual subrogation clause in it. The Court of Appeals there in 1913 said, just because you got a contractual subrogation clause or a reimbursement clause in your policy doesn't mean that you're entitled to the first money that comes into the hands of the insured. Under that circumstance, the insured is still entitled to be made whole before the insurance company is entitled to recoup any of its expenditures. So from 1913 forward, in an unbroken line of Texas cases,
And the reason is what?
Because the fundamental promise here, Your Honor, everything else is ancillary, essentially. The fundamental promise in this insurance contract is there's a risk, and we're going to pay, the insurer pays money to the insurance company on a regular basis to assume that risk, the risk of loss.
But if this provision were clear as day,
yes, sir,
that you got the money first, your argument would be that it's not enforceable. Why?
Because it's a contract of adhesion, Your Honor. Ms. Fortas has acknowledged here in front of y'all today, and as this court has repeatedly held in the context of the duty of good faith and fair dealing in other cases, and as courts across the United States have held, insurance companies give policies to the insured and says, there it is, take it or leave it. And the insured can't go in and say, well, wait a minute, we think it's not fair for you to put the burden or the risk of an uncompensated loss caused by a third party back with us. We want you to eliminate that reimbursement clause.
But we've also said adhesion contracts are not automatically unconscionable, not automatically.
And I agree with that, Your Honor. But we're not talking about it being automatically invalid. We're talking about a specific term in this contract that runs up against the fundamental central purpose of this contract.
Of course, we wouldn't be here if her policy was for $10 million instead of $2 million. or whatever it was.
I'm not following, Your Honor. I'm sorry.
In other words, the only reason there's a conflict is because the policy wasn't for $100 million in benefits. And whose choice was it that, to get a policy for this amount rather than $100 million or a billion or something that would have covered anybody under all circumstances?
I think what you're...
That's not an adhesion, right? That's a choice.
I'd still say that the amount of coverage... I'm not following, Judge. I'm sorry. I must be dense.
This is a medical...
Total damages your lady claims is what?
On this record, on the summary judgment record...
Just make up a number. What's the total? Is what?
Well, on this record, the summary judgment evidence is just over $2 million.
All right. So if she had gotten a policy, if she had bought a policy, which is more expensive, for $5
million, yes, sir,
they get everything they want.
I think that in that context, you're looking at a different remedy. In other words...
Just answer my question.
They don't get everything they want. No, sir. You're saying the insurance company gets everything they want? No, sir. Because that issue goes to after a recovery is made, just like in the workers' comp context. After the recovery is made, what's the insurance company's burden going forward? Now, that's a different question.
I'm not asking about that. Let's just do with the 247 right now.
Okay, Judge.
If she has a $50 million policy...
Right.
You have to pay him $247. But your position is you don't have to pay him a dime anymore.
I don't think so, Your Honor, because the maximum benefit that's available under the policy is irrelevant to the question of what has been paid on the policy and what has she recovered at the time of that payment. At the time that the decision is made, at the time that the request for reimbursement is made by the insurance company, what happens in the future doesn't count. They have another alternative remedy, which they hinted at in the trial court, and they suggested that they were going to pursue it, and their summary judgment affidavit, in fact, suggests that that remedy is going to be pursued on the basis of that affidavit, but they never pursued it. And that remedy is recognized in Texas case law. If you look at the Oss case that we cited out of the Fifth Circuit, the 1987 Fifth Circuit case, that case says that in the circumstances where a plaintiff recovers money and then doesn't reimburse the insurance company, that the insurance company in Texas law has the right to go to the court and say, whatever future obligations we have under this policy have been discharged on this injury. The second response there, Your Honor, is that there's nothing in this record that says that going forward they're obligated to renew this insurance policy. They have the choice, too. They can walk away from it. They can say, you know, we know Alamo anymore. We're done. You know, we're not going to pay you any more money anymore on this case. So whether it's a $10 million or a $50 million or a $100 million policy doesn't matter. The maximum benefits don't come into play. What comes into play is how much has been paid and how much has been recovered and how much are her total damages.
Mr. Cowher, in the case we just heard, we were talking about workers' compensation, and we heard a statement made that the carrier's contract says we'll pay what the statute says we'll pay.
Okay.
And that's what their contract is, so it simply incorporates those terms into their contract. And I think that may be, there may be some other cases that say that. So in workers' compensation, we have the legislature saying that the workers' comp carrier, in fact, gets first dollars and can bring the suit, and after it makes itself whole, then it pays the money to the injured employee.
Yes, sir.
And as I recall, it can also take whatever it pays the employee and offset future payments so it doesn't have to pay those.
Absolutely.
So how is that not a contract of adhesion, very similar to what your contract is here, only that one's imposed by the legislature? The employee gets it by going to work, employer buys it. How does that differ, if any way, from what we're talking about here?
I agree with you, Your Honor, but it's imposed by statute. I mean, that is a legislatively imposed solution.
But the employer doesn't have to buy a comp.
But when
in
it
Texas.
Does, yes, sir, and if my understanding is correct, the employee can opt out of the comp.
An employee has a choice. They can say, I don't want the comp, so everybody gets to choose.
It would be kind of odd for us to say something's against public policy when it's precisely what the legislature ordered.
But the issue there is that the workers' comp statute is a special breed. It's been recognized as a special breed by this court, by the other courts in Texas. It changes the common law. I mean, it's recognized. It eliminates common law tort claims brought by employees. You can't do it against a subscribing employee.
And certainly the legislature has chosen to codify some issues and not others. If they wanted to do this, they would have already done that. Would you argue that?
I think that's correct. And it's been done before. Georgia, one of the states that the petitioner says isn't within my 16 state majority that follows the rule that the Maypole Doctrine can't be overridden by contractual provisions. Has a statute, passed a statute in the late 90s saying you can't do that, that the common law Maypole rule applies to insurance policies in Georgia. Prior to that, the Georgia Supreme Court, in a case after that statute, the Georgia Supreme Court said, and that's always been the public policy of this state. So, I mean, there's a Georgia Supreme Court case from, and I've got the side of that if y'all want it, that says that that's always been the public policy in Georgia. It even predated that statute. But the point is that those workers' comp claim statutes and the longshoremen statutes and the Medicare statute and all these statutes that give insurance companies first money rights are special animals that the legislature intentionally went out and changed the common law to accomplish. They didn't express a policy of the state to say that the insurance companies always get first money recovery or that the insurance companies are entitled to contract for first money recovery. If that was the case, why wouldn't it be that all the elimination of a... Sorry, Your Honor, I lost my thought. The other thing to remember about the workers' comp policy is that the employee pays the premium. Employee pays the premium. That's an important issue because the case law says...
In workers' comp, the employee pays...
I'm sorry. Is that what I said? The employer pays
employer.
The premium.
Okay. Yes, sir.
And then I'm not wrong again. I'm having a hard time. The employer pays the premium. And that's an important issue because the case law says, why do you pay a premium to an insurance company? You pay a premium to the insurance company to bear a risk. So the injured party in the workers' comp context isn't the one paying somebody else to bear that risk. They're just getting the benefits of that policy.
But here you have the employee paying the premium.
Here we have the insured.
Which presumably is a smaller premium because the contractual subrogation clause in the contract, wouldn't you think?
Your Honor, I would argue, and I don't have any... I don't think insurance companies look at this and say, we're going to statistically recover some significant percentage of our expenditures. These are...
No, but they look at claims history and how much they've gotten paid back.
They do, but...
Well, there's no way for us to make that analysis here on what premiums are based on and whether or not there's a subrogation clause in a contract so that the insured can pay less premiums. I mean, those subrogation clauses are new, as I understand it, and I know my premiums hadn't been reduced in the last 5 years.
That's right, Your Honor, mine neither. And these policies, these premium or these subrogation clauses are in these policies.
The petitioner says that if it only has second money, it's really not going to do that. It's basically practically impossible. Now, it might be a circumstance, but as a practical matter, it's just not going to happen. Is there any answer to that?
I think there is, Your Honor. One of the answers that I would suggest to you is, this is the law in Texas today. They're asking this court to change the law. This goes back to 1913, 1995, with Esparza, applied it to a contractual subrogation clause. 2000 Ward case out of Waco applied to a statutory.
So we ever done it to?
No. This court has never ruled.
From time to time, we change what Waco says the law is.
I know that's the truth, Your Honor.
But fortunately, they're not always binding on us.
Right. But I'm saying that from 1913 forward, no court has ruled otherwise. But, Your Honor, if you look at the trend, this never comes up. I mean, think about insurance litigation. Think about coverage litigation. I recently changed jobs.
But does it not come up because you just can't get it?
No, sir, it doesn't come up because the rule works and people negotiate around the lien claims by insurance companies. And what the insurance company here today is saying is take all that allocating power of negotiations, all that risk allocating power of negotiations, and give it all to us. Because then it undoubtedly becomes a summary judgment matter because they've got a contract and they've got bills. And they go in and say, here it is.
Well,
here's our money.
I understand. But the argument that's being made is it's all on the other side now.
But it's not.
Well, why would you pay a dollar to them if you don't have to?
We do have to because there's a risk of litigation if we don't. Because they have the equitable subrogation right. They have a right to recover here, Your Honor. It's clearly recognized in the state of they have a cause of action. They have a right that they can bring to the court to say, we paid money, they recovered money, we get to participate in their recovery. How much they get is an open question, but they have the right to litigate that issue. So what the practical effect of this, you know, I recently worked on a class action case, and I remember what y'all said in Shine, Henry Shine, said that when courts think of efficiency, they should look at market models. And what you have here is a market where there's three players in the risk allocation that involves two transactions. And the risk is the plaintiff and the defendants, they allocate the risk of litigation going forward and the risk of high damages, low damages, thin liability, high little liability. They allocate that risk in between themselves and come up with the settlement determination. Then the plaintiff turns around.
But generally speaking, defendants don't settle by paying the plaintiffs more than the plaintiff they think the plaintiff is going to recover.
That's true.
Usually they pay you less. That's what a settlement's about. Everybody takes less.
They pay less than they think they're at risk for.
Right. Exposure.
Yes, sir.
And so the plaintiff is, seems to me, by definition, never made whole in those circumstances.
I don't think that that's necessarily true. I think that there are situations where the plaintiff may have been made whole, but even if they're not, then it becomes an allocating function because what happens is that the parties negotiate over that. Plaintiffs and defendants engage in one transaction to come up with a negotiated settlement agreement. Then, because there is this threat of litigation in between the insurance company and the plaintiff, with the uncertainty, essentially, sometimes uncertainty works, of what happens when you go back to the trial court on the subrogation claim, the reimbursement claim, the plaintiff and the insurance company then negotiates a separate settlement. And that's almost universally the way the situation works out. And that's why, if you look back, this came up in Esparza because the plaintiff thought that they got ripped off by $130,000 when the trial court split the baby and gave them half, each half. It came up in 95. It came up in Ward in 2000.
It's true, of course, that, you know, in contract cases, people negotiate. But the reason they negotiate after litigation is because they didn't negotiate before they signed the contract. And if they negotiate before they sign the contract and put it in the contract, they don't have what you're talking about, which is post-judgment, post-filing negotiation, because one of them is going to win. So didn't you all understand your argument? We didn't get to negotiate, but then insurance companies could make the same argument about the Texas Board of Insurance. But we don't normally disregard contracts unless there's really something illegal. There's nothing illegal about this.
I think contracts are disregarded for purposes of public policy on a regular basis. I mean, look at the Hoover versus Slocum Camp case that came out this summer. Slovacek. I couldn't remember the name. I know the case, but look at the multiple cases going back that say you can't get you can't insure against your own misconduct. Insurance companies aren't free to contract with insurers to protect them from their own immoral activity. You can't take a life insurance policy on somebody who you don't have an insured interest in. I mean, there's over and over again, this is not just a contract. This is an insurance contract.
But the rule is we enforce contracts. The exception is contracts are voided on public policy grounds.
I think you're right, Your Honor. And that, this is one of those exceptions.
That is right.
Yes.
If not, contract is meaningless.
Yes, sir. I agree. But this is one of those instances. And the fact is, you know, I cited to a Missouri Law Review article because I like the idea. I've got a law professor from 2005 who did the work. I don't have an amicus of subrogation professionals or TTLA or something like that. I have a law review from a law professor who did this survey. And he says 16 states, he didn't include Texas, I do in that count, 16 states say you can't overcome the made-whole doctrine just by a subrogation clause or a reimbursement clause. 10 states say you can, but it has to be clear, explicit, definite. You really got to say, I'm going to y'all's questions about where's the language in this contract. You got to really say it if you need it.
Well, what does it mean? What is your position that it means when it says we will be subrogated to all rights of recovery of a covered person? What does the word all mean in your view?
I think what that means on this policy, I think it's overreaching.
Does it mean everything then?
In my view, it does. In my view, just like I said in the brief, Your Honor, if I get a reimbursement of tuition overpayments in a bankruptcy proceeding by my second child's
But in this case, we have a specific set of circumstances. We're not litigating your child's. We're litigating the situation, or y'all are up here on the situation where you got a settlement, and right. Their policy says we are subrogated to all rights. Now, you're saying, is it your position that doesn't give them first money, or that gives them first money plus everything? I mean, it's one way that,
right.
I think his argument to start off with was you're taking inconsistent positions. It's not first money. But it's more than first money. So which
it's not first money because it's not clear and definite.
Okay, but then is
it
your position?
Clear and definite.
So it's not your position that it's more than first money.
It's an attempt to reach every cause of action that the family might have.
Well,
in my view. Now that doesn't.
But not all of the causes of action.
I think so. Not all of the causes
because,
of action.
And all of your causes of action, under your theory, all of these causes of action, you would get to be made whole first.
Yes.
So the term all doesn't really mean all under any circumstance.
It doesn't mean all of. It doesn't mean all of the cause of action. In other words, it doesn't mean all of the money that you might get from your cause of action. It's not all of, I don't think, Your Honor. I'd have to look back at the exact thing. But I think it's an attempt to reach any claim that the insured might have.
What's the effect of this case and other cases that are in a pipeline if Mr. Smith prevails? What type of effect would that have on?
I think what it does is that it limits the number of cases that would be. That's one thing. That's part of what the, you know, because that's what happens in ERISA cases.
It's kind of like
Fortis is trying to convert a normal private health insurance policy into an ERISA policy. And they're asking for more than that because more than the workers' comp, because under workers' comp, at least you can force them to pay your attorney's fees. And you've got a third under the statute and they have to share pro rata and the expenses. Under ERISA, the way the plans are written, you don't have to do that. It's an open question. Supreme Court of the United States ruled earlier this year whether that even a claim brought under an ERISA policy on a contract is an equitable claim. And they declined to say in that Sirbaugh case, which is cited in the briefs. In a footnote, they said, we're not considering whether it's an appropriate remedy given the made whole doctrine. We're leaving that open. So the issue of whether the made whole doctrine will ultimately apply in ERISA is still open. Until Sirbaugh, if it wasn't, the Fifth Circuit says it's closed. As far as the Fifth Circuit is concerned, it's closed. Insurance, the ERISA plan says we get first money. The lawyer doesn't get any money. The expenses don't get reimbursed. Nobody gets anything until the policy is reimbursed. The plan's reimbursed, and that's what they're trying to convert this into, where they have all the authority, they have all the power. Right now, the rule works. The rule's consistent with the majority rule in the United States, and it's supported by good public policy, and we think this ought to be affirmed.
Any other questions?
Thank you. Thank you, Jeff.
In rebuttal, I'd like to briefly touch on two statements that were made by counsel. First, that this was the majority rule of the other states, which we disagree with. And second, that this is a settled case law of this state as well, too. As to the case law of this state, the issue of whether or not a carrier can expand its equitable rights by contract was addressed by this court in the Employers Casualty Company versus Transport Insurance Company case from 1969. At issue in that case was the volunteer rule, which is a rule of equitable subrogation that a carrier can't recover or a subrogor cannot recover for voluntary payments. This court stated that the volunteer rule can be modified by contract because it says whether the payment of the debt of another is for the purpose of protecting an interest of one who pays the debt, whether it is paid because of a moral obligation, whether it is payment by a volunteer, all of these considerations are irrelevant in a case of conventional subrogation. Conventional subrogation is contractual subrogation. And if the subrogation provision of its policy does not authorize employee by employer's casualty from transport of a pro rata part of the sum paid as an attorney's fees in defense of the Siegel suit, equitable subrogation does. This court also, in the 2000 case, Texas Association of Counties Government Risk Pool versus Matagorda County found that there was no equitable right of subrogation for the carrier to go back against its insured for reimbursement. However, it did say, on balance, insurers are better positioned to handle this risk either by drafting policies to specifically provide for reimbursement or by accounting for the possibility that they may occasionally pay uncovered claims in a rate structure. In this case, we took that risk into account and we drafted a reimbursement clause that would provide us a right to recover our money back out of the settlement.
Let me ask you, it seems to say, by saying that limited to the amount of benefits we have paid, that your subrogation covers payments in the past but not future payments. Is that correct?
Exactly. And that's where it's not even as broad-reaching as workers' comp, because workers' comp gives a right of offset to future payments. In this case, we'd get back the amount that we paid, but we'd still be on the hook to pay the remaining $1.7 million available under the policy. Finally, under the majority rule that they talk about the other state, they cite a law review article. If you look at the details of that article, I think that they tally up the numbers wrong. Couch and Appleman, as we cite in the brief, state that the general rule is that you can modify your equitable rights by contract. But the split that the law review article from Missouri provides is 16-14. But two of those cases, Oklahoma and Iowa, actually go on the other side. They don't mention the Virginia case, which we cite, and they don't mention the D.C. case that we cite as well, too, that does say that you can modify your rights by contract. A couple of the states they mentioned, Michigan and North Carolina, as stating that you've got to follow the equitable rules. That's purely equitable contract cases. They're very dated cases. They don't deal with contractual subrogation. And then finally, the case from Colorado. I'm sorry.
Time is expired.
Thank you.
I have one question.
How do you respond to the argument that if you don't get reimbursed here, that you don't have to pay the future claims?
I'm sorry?
The argument was that if you have remedy, if you don't get reimbursed under these circumstances, that you don't have to pay any future benefits.
We don't have that in our policy. There was an amended petition that we stated that an alternative argument, and this was filed after the first summary judgment hearing, but before it was granted. We stated an alternative argument at the very end of our petition stating that they destroyed our right of subrogation. We cited a couple cases that say that this may relieve us of future benefits. And so that's in the petition, but that's not in the live petition before this court. Thank you.
That concludes the argument in this case, and the court will take another brief recess.
All rise.